Time Blong Master, the Australian involvement with Papua New Guinea.
In an area such as Aitapi, we found the head of the administration was a fine type of bloke, but I'm sure that the human rights people would have looked rather critically at some of his decisions. I know one in particular where a self-confessed rapist and a particularly nasty old man who'd raped a young girl in a village was brought before this particular Kiap. He actually lost control during the case and leapt over the desk and had hold of the prisoner by the throat. His feelings were so upset by the almost boasting description that the native offender gave. But then at the end of the case, he only gave him 3 months, calaboose. On hearing about this, I said, that's a bit weak. The guy did it and confessed it and even boasted about it. How come only 3 months? The Kiap said, well, if I consider he's worth more than 3 months, I've got to send him to Moresby. And in Moresby, he'll probably get 3 years at Bamana, which is a rest camp. They leave Bamana fitter and healthier than they went in and have a pretty good time while they're there doing nothing more laborious than cutting grass. He said, I've given him 3 months. He said, that keeps him here. And the minute he steps out of Calaboose, I'm going to grab him for another 3 months and another and another. He said, and he'll be beaten regularly like a gong. Now, this attitude, it's very easy to criticise his attitude, but at the same time, by native standards, he was doing the right thing.
Of all the components of Western civilization that Australia saw fit to impose on Papua New Guineans, a new concept of justice was one of the most puzzling aspects of the white man's rule. Until a few years before independence, the patrol officer, the Kiap, acted as the main instrument of dispensing justice to the villagers, arbitrating on civil disputes and dealing with minor criminal matters. He did his best to deal impartially with a range of problems immeasurably complicated by diverse cultural backgrounds, a task which required the wisdom of Solomon. Happily, instances of Kiap magistrates leaping over the court bench to assault the accused were rare, but the frustrations the judicial system imposed on those who had to administer and receive it were very evident. Dr. Hank Nelson.
If the government officer couldn't impose a superior system of law, then a major justification for his intervention in the lives of the people had disappeared. Inevitably, then, colonial governments were sensitive about their role as the carriers of new laws and of new ways of settling disputes. A problem in Papua New Guinea was that the traditional political units were so small. There was no centralised system that the colonial authority could take over and modify. It was a case of imposing Western law over an infinite variety of subtly changing local customs and values. And in the Papua New Guinean village, as in other communities, many legal decisions were also political decisions.
Kiap justice, as it's been called, has been very severely criticised, particularly by academic lawyers, and no doubt it was rough and ready justice, but it was justice and it was ready.
The native regulations and native administration regulations provided the main summary offences system for the Papua New Guineans. It provided for two courts, one in Papua, one in New Guinea, the Courts of Native Matters and the Courts of Native Affairs. And these courts were conducted by the Kiaps as magistrates. And if you were to be charged with an offence in those courts, you had to be a native.
There were laws about hygiene, adultery, stealing, laws about petty assault, 1,001 things, all covered by this code of regulations which gradually grew up and were added to over the years on both the New Guinea side and the Papuan side.
I myself felt, and I know my colleagues felt, that we were just and we were doing the right thing. We were both policemen in some circumstances, arresting officer, the prosecuting officer and the magistrate at the same time. I think we rather leaned over backwards to act each part independently of the other part. That's to say, as a magistrate, which is probably a bit funny, we took no notice of ourselves as a police prosecutor. We tried to be impartial. I think we did. Certainly, with that combination, we could cut corners a lot.
The criminal law of Papua New Guinea was essentially the Queensland Criminal Code of 1899, which was adopted in Papua in 1902 and in New Guinea in the 20s.
No doubt the court proceedings were puzzling, very confusing, and they didn't know how to handle it. But it was always taught us by the senior fellows that you've got to be firm and fair. That's the rule that we tried to follow all the time, firm and fair.
You'd put a table out in front of the house care, depend on what sort of climate you're operating in, but if it was hot, you'd probably put a big umbrella over yourself and sit there or get under the shade of a big tree with a table. You'd have your police boy standing beside you. You'd have your interpreter there if you needed an interpreter.
It was quite formal. The flag had to be up, a chair and table in which the patrol officer sat.
And where possible, it varied with camps, of course, but where possible, you would arbitrate. You'd get them together and discuss it, and you would attempt to resolve it in some satisfactory manner without a formal court case. But if there was the need for a formal court case, it couldn't be settled without, you would then make out your charge, you'd explain it as best you could to the person what he was charged with, you would take the evidence, you were both prosecutor and defender, and you'd take both sides of the case, you'd make your decision, you'd enforce it. If it was jail, you'd take them back to jail. But mostly in this sort of thing, it'd be some sort of adjustment of property or adjustment of pigs or payment of money or something of this nature.
Land, pigs and women. They're the three. Anyone you talk to from way back to nowadays, the three they come up with are those three.
Adultery does cause difficulties in the villages, and the people wanted the Kiaps to be able to do something about it. Charging the adulterer with a criminal offence was the easiest way of handling the matter. Usually a small fine was imposed or a prison sentence was imposed. The Kiap was seen then as solving the problem, removing the offender from the community for a short period if he was sent to prison, and that settled the dispute. And it's a much more serious matter in the Papua New Guinean societies than it is in the expatriate British-oriented society, where adultery is seen as far less important these days than it was, say, 200 or 300 years ago, when damages could be obtained in the courts by a person who had been cuckolded.
Before you dealt with any matter, the preamble to the regulations clearly stated that you had to inquire into the native customs applying to this particular matter. And you dealt with the matter in that light.
You'd get it from the old men, through an interpreter if possible, and then even if we didn't have an interpreter, you could find out somehow or other. You had to know how they spoke, and you could pick up things from them, but I don't know, it's just intuition. It certainly influenced us a lot.
Australians, at the time they administer this country, I think the extent and depth of understanding of the customs and ways of life of the people was not very deep. Basically, they regarded the people as savages, and if they were gentle, they qualify that term by calling them gentle or noble savages. So there really was not much concern about any local institution that might exist. So they just adopted the Queensland Criminal Code as a law that was relevant and applicable.
People might come in with a matrimonial problem. You'd hear A story, the husband's story, and B, the wife's story, for about half an hour, and you might make some sort of decision which you thought was reasonable, and probably was fairly reasonable when you look at it through the Europeans' eyes, but which may not have been the best solution for them when you take into account the enormous complexities that are involved with marriage in their society. Marriage, for instance, played a far more important role in their society than it does in ours, in the sense that the ties between husband and wife had far-reaching effects between clan groups, you know. Monies that were paid for brides, goods that were paid for brides, gifts that were given for brides were passed from clan to clan and had an important meaning for ties between the clan groups. But quite often young men didn't appreciate these things. You know, they might have sat down for an hour or two to listen to the people, but really that wasn't enough. Talking to people later on, I know that problems like that would have taken many more hours, if not days, to have been solved by the people themselves in the old days, when the elder members of the clan group would have sat down with them and talked and argued and discussed for many, many hours. You know, the Papua New Guinean had infinite patience. The Australian may have had a certain amount of patience if he didn't have the time.
It's a one-man show. I mean, if the Kiap says he's guilty, well, he's guilty. Well, to some extent, the Kiap ruling was seen as an addition to what the old people have. Even if it's unjust, they see it as something that there is no way of having an appeal about it, because the Kiap's word is it.
The whole idea was to have a simple set of regulations that could adapt to tribal custom and take the place of the more savage sanctions. From the beginning, it had to be recognised, of course, that their system of justice and their system of law and order was different from ours. Melanesian systems of justice depend a great deal on compensation for those injured. This compensation was vital. Really, vendetta could be avoided if the compensation was big enough, but it never was, and of course people were too proud to bring tribute. I mean, that would concede dominance, and so killing resulted. In other words, the only compensation for a murder would be another killing if the people were not able to compensate those injured sufficiently. But in terms of, you know, people snatching other people's wives or abducting their children or killing their pigs or encroaching on their land, and those sort of things were all matters of compensation, and you'd go along with this. You didn't necessarily put everything through the legal processes of the court.
Nearly always, if there's a little bit of incentive to do so, people can arrange some sort of compromise themselves. And my approach would be to say, well, you have, in this community, you have certain men who are standing, who understand your ways, who understand your customs, who are involved in this sort of thing all the time, who should be able to assist and advise you on this. Use them. The Luluwai, the Tultul, some other village leader is here. Sit down over there, under my eye. If they were Highlanders, they usually had axes with them, and I'd usually insist that the axes be left out of reach, parked over on the side somewhere, and then we'll have a discussion about it. And discuss they would. They'd argue and orate and carry on for hours, quite often. And quite often, they did reach some sort of a, if not a consensus, at least some sort of agreement, always with the underlying threat almost, in that I would say, well, look, if you can't settle this, then I must. It's my duty to. And if I make a decision, of course, that will be supported by the full authority of the government. There are sanctions and things which apply here, and I'll make sure that you do what I say, but maybe it'd be better if you sort it out for yourselves. Maybe it'd be better if you decide on something, because maybe nobody will like what I decide. And with this sort of incentive, quite often they did reach some sort of conclusion. So that sort of thing was done a lot, certainly by me, by others, and I think it was almost a standard sort of procedure.
The villagers did depend on it. Maybe it was wrong. Maybe it was bad that we stole from them the power to settle their own disputes. I don't know. We set up a system which replaced the village system. Looking back, should we probably have said, well, righto, we'll listen. Now you fellas get in and settle this yourself. We did this a lot. They did settle a lot of their own problems. But there were many Kiaps and many cases where there were probably too many court cases held, and it denuded the powers of the village as a village organisation, perhaps.
The plain fact of the matter is that until the late 60s, the overwhelming majority of court cases heard in Papua New Guinea in the lower courts, that is up to district court level, were conducted by Kiaps. As recently as 1969 or 1970, there were only four professional stipendiary magistrates in all of New Guinea. Without the Kiaps, the system couldn't have worked. It's been claimed that we were completely untrained, but this is not so. Those of us that did the two-year diploma course at the School of Pacific Administration did a very, very comprehensive and solid law course, patterned on the law course at Sydney University. But, of course, it must be admitted most of us learnt on the job. And I studied a lot, as most of us did. It was an important aspect of the job, and we took it very seriously. However, it would be certainly idle to say that in comparison with the modern Australian legal system that this wasn't a fairly crude and primitive system.
In the pre-war days particularly, the judicial system often adopted a tough approach, particularly when dealing with tribal murders and headhunting, which could involve cannibalism. The patrol officer, or district officer, would often be the only European in an area, and had to carry out a range of government functions that almost eclipsed the list of official hats W.S. Gilbert created for the legendary Pooh Bah. Bill Bloxham recalls one occasion in the Sepik district where he had to track down and arrest a man wanted for some particularly brutal tribal killings.
I went in with my squad of police to apprehend this murderer. The murderer had resisted arrest and was shot in the arm by one of my native police. He was then brought back to the government station at Marienburg, where there was no doctor or medical assistant. I patched him up until he was fit for trial. Then, in the district court, I committed him for trial for murder at the Supreme Court, which is then in Rabaul. So in my function as head jailer, I then took him into custody. To be transferred from one jail to another, as head jailer, I had to sign a series of documents authorising the head jailer in Rabaul to take him over. As a protector of natives, I then had to put in an informal report explaining the degree of civilization, where the crime had been committed, and any other relevant facts. Eventually, after trial in Rabaul, he was sentenced to death, and he was brought back to me, and I had to supervise his execution as the officer of the sheriff. He was then taken to the place where the crime was committed, was hanged from a tree with an assemblage of all the local chieftains. I might say that headhunting and murder had been quite common in this part of the world, and as a reminder of the power of the government and what it could do to people who offended their code, the rope which had used to hang him was cut into sections about 18 inches long, and a section was handed to every chieftain from that area. That was a grim reminder, but I think that it paid dividends in the long run.
The frontier nature of life in Papua New Guinea tended to attract some notable individuals. The bench was no exception.
Certainly one of the greatest characters amongst the judges was Mr. Justice Gore, whom I'm very glad I arrived in time to see in action on circuit. And he had been there in the early 1920s and used to do these circuits on horseback, leaving Port Moresby and heading off into the mountains. So he really knew a lot about the country and a lot about the people, and I think had long ago put aside most of the niceties of legal procedure that some of the more recent judicial appointments have brought with them from Australia.
One case that former public solicitor Toss Barnett recalls before Mr. Justice Gore in the early 1960s concerned an old man who'd been charged with murdering his daughter. The girl had reneged on an arranged marriage with an older man, thereby causing all kinds of problems about repayment of the bride price and other social embarrassments. The girl had drowned, and the prosecution alleged that the father had killed her and then thrown her body into the water. The defence made much of medical evidence which suggested that the girl was dead before she entered the water, and was successful.
Judge Gore acquitted the man, very reluctantly, and then he called all the headmen in and lined them up in the back of the court. The defendant was still there, looking at him, a very strong, charactered man, the defendant. And Gore just got stuck into them. And to see this enormously large white man with a red robe and a bald head thumping the bench and saying, "Look, I've been coming here for years and years and years, and I have told you people that these practices of selling your young daughters in marriage have got to stop," and thumped the table again. He said, "Now look, I know you did it, but I've got to acquit you. I've got to let you go free. But you are a dirty old man. Now get out." And the fellow sank to his knees and burst into tears and crawled out of the courthouse. And the lineup of the old fellows in the back just sort of quivering. Now the difference between that approach and the more modern judicial approach is very marked.
Through most of Australia's rule, there were three levels of courts. At the lowest level were the Kiap courts. In the middle were the district courts, and at the top was the Central or Supreme Court, which had jurisdiction in all serious criminal or civil cases. In the 1930s, there were usually only two judges in Papua and two in all of New Guinea. The judges of the Mandated Territory of New Guinea sometimes administered a harsh system. In the 20 years before the war, one white man and 66 New Guineans were hanged in the territory. There have been no executions since 1957. As there was no jury in cases involving Papua New Guineans, the judge alone decided matters of fact and imposed sentence. The enormous responsibility on the judges was increased by the Native Customs Recognition Ordinance, under which they might have to decide what was custom and then enforce it.
From 1962, Sir John Minogue was a judge of the Supreme Court, and from 1970 to 74, he was the Chief Justice of Papua New Guinea.
The policy of the court was a simple one. Briefly, it was to show the face of justice to the people, to allow everybody to see justice in fact being done, with the result that we travelled all over the countryside, from the larger towns. Of course, our main centre was in Port Moresby, the main seat of the court. And we travelled to the tiniest of hamlets out in the, what I might still call, the most primitive of areas. And I might add that, particularly in the highlands, and in those remote areas, we sat in our full criminal court rig, that is, of scarlet robes and grey horsehair wigs. But that wasn't all that incongruous, in that the people of those areas were great wig people themselves, and a great deal of time was spent in preparation of the wigs that they wore.
See, our people are ceremonial people, and ceremony is one of the most important parts of our culture. Symbolism, mystery, power of God. So these things became identified with this mysterious symbolism. So wigs really added the aura and the mysticism that was associated with the white man's law.
We would stand in our gowns and we'd bow to the judges who came in. If it please Your Honour, I appear for the defence, and we would refer to each other as my learned brother and Your Honour and whatever. The full procedure, the full laws of evidence, just as if it was in Australia. And even though it was hot, we wore the robes. Occasionally, if it was right up in the sweltering sepik, some of the judges would say that it would be quite all right if we felt like taking our robes off, and then we'd just do it in shirt sleeves.
The courts were not made so formal that they were frightening to people. And the Supreme Court did have a policy, certainly in the colonial period, of going out to the people. And that's why we went to places like Simbai and even out to Gembog and some rather difficult places to get to. The court came out to the people so that they could come in from the local villages and see what the strange aspect of the administration was about. And I think that reduced the awesomeness of it. I think Chief Justice Minogue saw that as a particular role of the court.
We would arrive in an area as a court party with the judge and his associate, the counsel for the prosecution and counsel for the accused, because in all those cases, in every Supreme Court case, wherever it was held, there was always counsel provided by the public solicitor for the accused person. And then we would have the court opened. It was usually done as a little ceremony in that a police guard was provided for the judge to inspect before he went into court. It was a ceremony which seemed to be appreciated, which certainly always drew a big audience, even though the guard only consisted of half a dozen policemen. The judge would walk along, inspect the guard, and then go in and open the court. The cases would be called on, and the charge would be read to the accused in English, but it was then translated into, firstly, if it was on the New Guinea side, into Pidgin, if on the Papuan side, into Police Motu, which is the lingua franca of Papua. And then, dependent on the language involved, it would be translated once again into another language through another set of interpreters into what we call the place talk of the area. Indeed, by way of digression, I recall a case in Wewak many years ago in which we had 20 accused, I think it was. Very, very primitive people. This is the first case that had been heard from this area.
They had been brought down from the May River, which is up near the West Irian border. They were charged, and we had to have four interpreters. And as might be expected, the case collapsed in confusion. We couldn't get through to them eventually. In the early days, we sat in grass huts, and indeed I can recall in Kundiawa, up in the Chimbu area, sitting in a round grass hut with a bare earth floor and being bothered by wandering chickens under my feet. And I was hearing a civil case where a poor fellow was carried in on a stretcher. He'd been a quadriplegic, and hearing his case, and the chickens were scratching under his stretcher in the court floor as the case was being heard.
Sorcery and the belief in sorcery was and is a feature of Melanesian life. It was a subject that Australian courts found extremely difficult to come to terms with.
I defended a number of people who were charged with killing sorcerers, and they believed that sorcerers did have the power to kill other people by their forms of magic, and it was a matter of self-defence to dispose of a sorcerer. Let's take one case which occurred down in the Milne Bay area. A woman was sick. A man who had claimed to have killed 29 people through sorcery came to her place and threw leaves in the window. He then got in his canoe and rowed away. Her husband gathered a couple of friends and they chased him. They believed that if he started a fire and blew smoke in her direction, she would die, because that was the next and final process in the magic. So when they caught him, they killed him. Well, under our law, provocation as a defence would not apply, because there was time for their passions to cool. It wasn't of a sudden. There was a relatively long time period. Self-defence doesn't apply, because he hadn't really done anything which was a direct and immediate threat to this woman in our perception, in our law. Insanity doesn't apply, because perfectly sane Papua New Guineans believe in sorcery, and that's the view that's been established in Africa and elsewhere by colonial courts. So those people were found guilty of willful murder. Fortunately, the judge only gave them very light sentences, but in the view of their community, they were heroes, because they'd killed a man who'd said he'd killed 29 people, and a great evil had been removed from the community. But the giving of a light sentence did solve the problem to a degree. In fact, one of the convicted murderers developed cancer in prison, and the authorities were humane enough to release him so that he could go home, and he died in his village. They got 3 years, which was too much, really, given that, you know, in the view of their colleagues, they were not guilty at all.
We tried to, when sentencing in these cases, perhaps I shouldn't go back, because in 1969, after continued representations from the bench, the judges were given the power to impose a penalty for murder other than the death penalty. Early on, there were two sorts of penalties, and this goes back to the Queensland Criminal Code. You could either pronounce sentence of death, which meant that the judge ordered the prisoner to be taken to the place from whence he came and there be hanged by the neck until he was dead, or you could record sentence of death. If the judge felt there was room for mercy, he would record sentence of death and then write a report through the administrator to the Governor-General recommending mercy, and usually recommending what sort of a sentence ought to be imposed in lieu of the death penalty. Well, we started to lobby, as it were, for this to be changed, because when you had to go through one or two languages to try and explain to both the prisoner and the people gathered round that you were going to write all this in a book, that he was to die, we didn't know quite when. We were going to write to a big man down in Australia and see what he said about it, and then we'd know the answer in a few weeks' time. Well, that was just not good enough in that area, and it created a great deal of confusion. So the law was amended to allow, where the judge found special circumstances, that he could impose a penalty. Well, now, to return to sorcery, we tried to tell the community what a bad thing and what a false thing sorcery was. But I think that is a hopeless task.
Unfortunately, this is a problem which simply nobody has been able to deal with. Papua New Guineans are firmly convinced that sorcery is carried out. I am equally firmly convinced that it is not, and that it is an imagined offence. Now they have independence, of course. they have imposed laws against people charged with sorcery. This is, I think, a mistake. Once a person has been charged in a court and proved guilty of sorcery, then he has a diploma.
In 1940, there were nearly 1,000 Papua New Guineans in jail. On the eve of independence in 1975, over 20,000 were in jail. In Pidgin, they were the Kalabus Man. Nearly all of them were serving short sentences with hard labour. They cut grass, made roads and worked pit saws. To go to Kalabus was one of the common experiences of those Papua New Guineans who left their home villages. In the eyes of their own clansmen, many prisoners had done nothing wrong. They had merely been caught for violating some alien law. Particularly in newly contacted areas, the Kalabus Man might return to his own community with no stigma and knowing more about the outside world than anyone else. Members of the white community constantly asserted that the jails were rest homes or country clubs. They talked as though their own security depended directly on a harsh prison system. But Papua New Guineans had no doubt that the Kalabus was a place of punishment.
I don't think anybody enjoyed being deprived of their freedom. And I can recall whenever I was sentencing, and I think my brother judges did this also, I would go to some lengths to explain that they were going to a place where they wouldn't be able to see their family, they wouldn't be able to enjoy the sexual company of their wives, they would be forbidden to have their evening meal as they did in company of their villagers. And I noted time and time again the looks of almost despair on the face of some of these, particularly mature men, when they realised this is what was going to happen to them.
The warders were good to the people. The prisons weren't particularly secure. Usually they were only a big fence with huts inside it. And also the people in prison were well fed. They had three square meals a day and they had to work in the fields, and often they came out of prison with their skin all shiny and apparently in good condition. But against that, they were locked in for 13 hours a day every day. Now, that's not something that happens in the villages. Village life is very much you can do what you like when you like. There's no 9-to-5 jobs in the village. And that sudden deprivation of liberty for more than half the day was very significant. I defended quite a lot of people, over 100 people in my time in Papua New Guinea, and not one of them ever said that he wanted to go to prison. And in fact, those who raised the subject indicated quite clearly that prison was the last place they wanted to go to. It wasn't the cushy place that a lot of members of the white community said it was. It was hard work. You had to live with people in very close proximity, people who might have included some of your traditional enemies, people you'd never seen before, and you had to work. Not the sort of thing that the average Papua New Guineans used to or desires.
The Supreme Court took into account the background situation and so on. And the chap that did 9 months or a year or 2 years or 3 years in jail and then went back to his village often became a government official when he went back, because he was the one that had most experience of the outside world. He'd probably learnt to speak pidgin or motu, as the case may be. He had contact with the police and others, because in those early days the police were the prison guards as well as policemen. And when the government patrol came around, he possibly had a couple of friends in the patrol itself. It was more a compulsory education than a prisoner, I suppose, in a sense. There was no social stigma, for a start. It didn't automatically brand him as a person to be despised or treated differently in any way.
The attitude of the judges in my time was very much against giving death sentences. They were required, when a person was convicted of willful murder, to give a death sentence unless they found extenuating circumstances, but they found extenuating circumstances. The judges wanted to, because they didn't want execution, because I think they felt it was an inappropriate penalty and they couldn't see that it was going to help. And so as long as we on the defence side gave them some evidence that showed extenuation, they would accept that and then impose at the most a life sentence and usually a term of years. And the sentences ranged very widely from the rising of the court, from effectively no sentence at all, right through to life. 2- and 3-year sentences were not uncommon. for first contact people or people in very remote areas, but the more sophisticated the person was, the more heavy the sentence was.
From the start, Australians introduced the adversary system of justice. Where possible, a Papua New Guinean facing a serious charge would be defended by a legal or field officer. In 1962, the Public Solicitor's Office was set up to extend legal aid for Papua New Guineans. Some Papua New Guineans immediately used the Public Solicitor's Office to take land cases to the Supreme Court. This was taken by some Australians as a demonstration of faith by Papua New Guineans in the legal system. But others saw the Public Solicitor's Office as bringing them massive amounts of work and perhaps overthrowing decisions they'd made. Toss Barnett was one of the first public solicitors.
For a while I was extraordinarily successful in defending people because I was the first defence counsel to go into quite a few of these areas. And prior to that they'd been defended by patrol officers who really had not much idea of law. And of course what I found when going into the Southern Highlands, for instance, because they'd not had to face a trained defence counsel before, the standard of the prosecution and the way they'd collected their evidence was sloppy. I'm known as Toss Barnett, but was known as Toss Em Out Toss, because I remember on one circuit nearly every confession was thrown out because they hadn't followed the sometimes fairly technical procedures required by the judge's rules on taking confessions, had failed to formally caution the man that everything he said may be used in evidence against him. So that as often their cases depended entirely on the confession, to have them all thrown out really mucked up the administration of justice. I mean, on one hand I'd had a very successful circuit, but on the other hand I'd really mucked up things. And you become a little bit uneasy. You can imagine the patrol officers got a bit irate sometimes that the court was so concerned only in the formalities as they saw it, in the principles as we saw it, of justice, and without taking into consideration the effect of the decisions on the practical administration of the area. And of course, probably the epitome of that process occurred at Kundiawa one time, when there were two of us actually defending a group of Abura people from Kainantu area who had been accused of killing about four Chimbus who had come through. The leading defendant was a gentleman called Taitan Dow, who's an old chap, and apparently one of their clansmen had been killed in an accident working on a plantation on the coast. And as it happened, the accident was nobody's fault, but he was dead. And this upset them, naturally. And in their custom, if they've suffered a loss, either compensation is paid to redress the loss, or else they take a life to redress the loss. And so they heard that there were some Chimbus in the area, who in fact come from a little bit further towards the coast than Kainantu, but not that much further. Certainly nowhere near the coast. And these unsuspecting people were travelling through the area collecting bird-of-paradise feathers for a sing-sing. And Taitan Dow and his group ambushed them. They lined up on both sides of the path and killed them as they were going through. So we were defending Taitan Dow and his group. And the nature of the defence was possibly going to be successful, I don't know. It was based on the fact that under the Queensland Criminal Code, you either had to prove that each particular individual had either done the killing or had aided the person who did the killing and knew that he was aiding him at the time. We'd actually made legal history previous to that in another case which went to the High Court, where we exposed a gap in those sections in the criminal code. So maybe one of them or all of them could have been acquitted. But we never know, because the Chimbus, who were the relatives of the people who'd been killed, knowing this possibility, arrived by truck. And when the court stopped for the evening adjournment and we wended our way back from the courthouse up towards the pub where we were all staying, the police took Taitan Dow back towards the jail and the Chimbus killed him. The first thing we knew about it was a policeman arrived with two beaming Chimbu gentlemen, each of them still holding the axe with blood pouring down its blade and wanting to tell us that we've just killed Taitan Dow, which they had. They were extremely proud and happy that they'd managed to accomplish that. And you know, you really get the feeling that something is wrong with the system, or certainly that it's not being understood anyway by the people that are having it imposed on them.
The Australian legal system failed to be comprehensive. Many villagers continued to run their own systems of settling disputes and punishing those who broke locally accepted rules. The Australian established courts were either too far away or seen as irrelevant, or the communities were just reluctant to let the fate of their members be decided by outsiders. For the Australian government to carry out its aim of introducing courts that were accessible and universal, it had to do either of two things. It had to spend more money to extend the national systems of law enforcement and courts into the villages, or it had to bring the informally operating village courts into the national system. It never quite did either.
For a long time, quite a tension between the judiciary and the administration never entirely disappeared, but in later years it was very much relieved and we got on quite well together on the whole. But the Kiaps in particular, I think, always thought that we were too soft in our administration, not realising that we were judges, not administrators.
I was never confident about justice.
Former Assistant Administrator Sir John Gunther.
For two reasons. I was hearing two groups of people who in their different ways were experts. And I'm pretty certain the administrator, Sir Donald Cleland, was in the same sort of boat, although he was slightly different because he was a lawyer. One was that justice should start at the grassroots, should be administered by the native affairs people, and should go right back into the village, and the village should be the first court of justice. The village would manage its own affairs, provided their traditional behaviour didn't conflict with the criminal code or the native regulations. But then there were the judges who said no, under no circumstances. You've got to have skilled officials giving out justice to the people, and that you can't go back into the grassroots because the village, they don't really know what justice means, sort of thing. Now, in any argument, as far as the public servant was concerned, as far as I was concerned, I think the argument of the judges had to prevail. But we got this constant barrage, particularly from the younger thinking Kiap, the man like Sinclair, or like Fenbury, who put forward constantly arguments why justice at the level of a magistrate's court and then to a district court and then to a Supreme Court was an anachronism in a traditional community. However, once again, it's up to the people to decide what kind of courts they want to have. By the time they get independence, we'll have given them a number of lawyers from a university who can advise them one way or another, and if they want village courts, they can have village courts. It's as easy as that. And they've got village courts.
In Courts and Calaboose, you heard the voices of Alan Curry, Jim Sinclair, Nick O'Neill, John Murphy, Bob Cole, Lloyd Hurrell, Fred Card, Ian Skinner, Bernard Narokobi, Chris Vass, Leo Hannett, Ian Downes, Neil DeSaley, Bill Bloxham, Toss Barnett, Sir John Minogue, Professor Ian Hoban, and Sir John Gunther. Comment was by Dr. Hank Nelson, Fellow in the Department of Pacific and Southeast Asian History at the Australian National University.